It's Sunday, October 4th, and you are listening to Peanuts and Popcorn. P&P is a spontaneous podcast between two old friends on baseball and motion pictures. I'm Tom Hockney.
And I'm Leo Fontana. This week on Peanuts and Popcorn, Tom and I are deep in mourning over the passing of our hero, Bob Gibson. The first round of the MLB playoffs is over. What did we learn? White Sox fans are mad at ESPN, and we'll look at the best 60-game stretch by an individual player ever. The Tigers and the Red Sox are looking for new managers, and a very old name has taken off the MVP trophy. We'll talk about the Chicago Cubs' final week of the 2020 season, and our popcorn segment is on the Ilya Kazan Classic on the waterfront. How are you doing, Tom?
I'm doing pretty well this morning. How are you?
I'm all right. This weather is kind of bringing me down. You know, we're looking at a really long, hard, cold winter, you know.
Yeah, you know, it's in many ways, in more than just the weather. So yeah. It's
exactly
this week. We're dealing with loss and we're dealing with COVID. It's just these are uncharted waters. But I can't help but think what my late great mother would say: "This too shall pass."
And it shall. And hopefully we'll live long enough to see it happen. But this week we lost two figures in the music world, one of which I was a big fan of, and that's Helen Reddy. Yeah. And, you know, Helen Reddy is known for her song Delta Dawn.
I am woman here.
Yeah, I blew that. Helen is known for I Am Woman. That's kind of her big. But for me, my favorite Helen Reddy song is Delta Dawn by far. It's a great song.
Yeah. She came along at, the burgeoning portion of the women's movement, and she became – an icon, a feminist icon, in the early 1970s. It just was, I remember just having a point of amusement, which was in the early 70s, she was this, you know, she was ubiquitous. She was on every TV show. She just was, you know, and she was on the
lips from down under, you know what I mean?
Yeah, she was on the lips of a lot of people's mouths. But by 1978 or 79, her career was starting to wane, so much so that I was walking at the Michigan State Fair, which is nothing like the Wisconsin State Fair. It's kind of a low rent deal. And there she was headlining one of the main stages. And I thought, wow, how the mighty have fallen. And so that was kind of interesting. Also, Matt Davis passed away this past week too. And his career was very, their careers were at the very same time in the 1970s. He's kind of a man's man, and the reason why I bring it up is that he was in one of my favorite movies of the 70s, North Dallas 40. And But Mac Davis was mostly known as a songwriter. He wrote he had some hits himself, country hits, but he wrote music for other people.
He was the quarterback in North Dallas 40 who made questionable moral decisions.
Yes, you know? Correct. That's putting it mildly. I just wanted to, you know, kind of briefly bring up that, COVID's had an interesting week this week.
Yeah, it really has.
I don't mean to laugh, but I just think it's kind of also in developing news, this is breaking news, actually. Anthony Fauci has tested positive for I Told You So 19.
You know, you wrote in the rundown, though, that COVID-19 gets a high target.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, when people find out that Cam Newton has COVID-19, they're really going to, that's really going to affect their fantasy teams. So they're going to be really disappointed.
Yeah. What I meant was the president in the early aughts, there used to be like trading cards for Iraqi, high targets. And each time they would be taken out, the card would be thrown, you know, kind of. So, kids, wear your mask. Don't listen to the president. Wear your mask.
I mean, our thoughts and prayers are with the president.
Yeah, exactly.
I hope he recovers, mostly because I don't want anything to interfere with this election.
Me either. And also, as much as I dislike with the policies and the man personally, I do not wish him ill. I want him to get. I don't want anybody to die from COVID.
I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy, and he's not even my worst enemy. But
Hitler's already dead.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so let's get to the peanuts here. And we're going to begin with something that happened this week that really, I think, has affected both of us deeply.
I think it's the biggest story of the week, really.
It's the biggest story of the week, and quite possibly, I mean, it's the biggest baseball story of the year, that Bob Gibson, St. Louis Cardinals Hall of Fame pitcher, passed away, died from pancreatic cancer, I think at the age of 86.
Mm-hmm.
And
84, I'm sorry, 84.
84. This is a man who, you know, he's a hero of mine. I've read two biographies about Bob Gibson, one by Roger Angel. I also read his shorter essay, which recounted a portion of his life in The New Yorker. You know, I've seen countless interviews. I've read countless articles. Yeah. I've heard countless stories about the impact he made while he was on the mound, how fierce he was as a competitor, how great a teammate he was, and also how intimidating he could be on the mound, you know. And
he held grudges too. He held grudges.
He did hold grudges. He was a bitter guy. But, I mean, this is what makes the sport so interesting, is that everybody's not the same. I mean, you know, here he is, this black man, a proud black man from Omaha, Nebraska, you know, who is the one of maybe the six or seven dominant pitchers of that era. And, you know, he was a black man who's playing in an era where civil rights are a huge issue, but he's not this guy who's looking to reconcile and be nice and be all touchy-feely and happy. And he's going to call racism out when he sees it. Okay. And he's going to let you know, and he's not going to let you know in a really pleasant way. And that's kind of the way he pitched as well.
And he was colorblind when he pitched. He treated blacks and whites exactly the same.
He did do that. Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's important for people to realize, just in a year when we've lost, you know, Al Kaline, we've lost Tom Seaver, Lou Brock, another great Cardinal. This is, and the reason is, when you look at his stats, he only won 251 major league games in 17 seasons.
So yeah, not a 300 game winner, but his career ERA is just,
But if you break down those stats, you could make a case that he's the greatest pitcher. In fact, when we originally started talking about sports way back in the Cody's days, we used to have a line. You're in the seventh game of the World Series. You have one pitcher. Who are you going to tap to throw that last game? I always said Bob Gibson. But Bob Gibson is my man. If I've got one game to pitch, I'm giving the ball to him. And why? Because in the postseason, he was incredible. But if, let's just break down a couple of things that stick out even after this point. And I went as far as to look at an index of his stats versus a modern pitcher who is considered one of the greatest, and that's Clayton Kershaw. And if you compare Gibson to Kershaw, you'll see Kershaw in his 13 seasons in the majors has 25 complete games and 15 shutouts. Bob Gibson had 56 shutouts and 255 complete games.
Yeah.
255 complete games. I mean, it's astounding. His season in 1968 is what Babe Ruth's 1921 hitting season was, simply the greatest pitching season ever. So much so that they changed the mound after that season because of him and Denny McClain, but mostly because of Bob Gibson.
Well, they say that 1968 was the year of the pitcher, but Roger Angel wrote that it was really the year of the infield pop-up.
Yeah.
And you look at that year where his ERA is just so small, 1.12, and you wonder, how does a man lose eight games in a season like that? And the reason is that he's going up against other pitchers from other teams who were also tremendous pitchers. He would always match up against Marichal or Koufax or Drysdale, or always the other team's best pitcher. That's why maybe his win totals weren't as high as they could have been, or maybe his win total certainly that season wasn't as high. But there's some really good stories about Gibson, and there's one that I always remember. And it has to do with the 1965 All-Star Game. And his friend, Joe Torre, is catching. And Torre tells the story that Tony Oliva is coming up, okay, to bat. And he's pinch hitting. And so Torre's like, I better talk to Gibson. So he calls time, goes out to the mound. And he's like, listen, don't throw Oliva anything down and in. He just kills that stuff. You know, and Gibson's just kicking the dirt and adjusting his hat. And he's like, just, you know, he doesn't say anything, but you can tell he's irritated. Okay. Torrey goes back behind the plate and Gibson throws him a slider down and in, and Oliva crushes it into the corner for a double. Okay. He does exactly what Torrey told him not to do. He strikes out the next two hitters and they go off and you go into the dugout, and Torrey's just like, what's your deal, dude? What is your deal? Why are you so angry? You know, it's just, that's who he was. It's cool.
You know? For me, just one last story on Gibson. The very last pitch that Gibson threw in the major leagues was hit for a grand slam by Pete LeCocq,
yeah,
who, by right, the way, is the son of the TV host.
Or the father of the son.
The son of Peter Marshall.
Right, okay.
So the last thing that Gibson ever did in the majors is he gave up a grand slam to Peacock. Fast forward a decade later, they were at an old-timers game at Wrigley Field. LeCocq comes up to the plate, and Gibson just hits him right in the shoulders.
Yeah, right.
And Costa says, you know, what the heck is – what's up with that? You know, and Gibson's like, you know, I never forget, you know.
Yeah, the scales 10 years, must be balanced.
He still remembered.
He didn't forget. He held grudges. He hit his friend. He hit his good friend, Bill White.
Correct.
Story he tells on Charlie Rose, but you know, White would like to try to yank that outside pitch and try to pull it. And Gibson told him once, he said, if you ever tried to do that with me, I'm going to have to drill you. And he did it.
And
White called him crazy as he's walking to first, and Gibson is yelling at him saying, you son of a bitch, that outside part of the plate is mine.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
I mean, he's fighting for what's his, and you have to admire that kind of intensity, you know. I'm going to say one last thing too. He never faced Ted Williams in a ball game except for a time during spring training. And it was the only at bat they ever had, and Williams hit a double off of him. And they talked about it later. They were much older. And Williams said, yeah, you hit my slider. And he said, no. Ted Williams said, no. First, you threw me your two fastballs. I swung and missed. Then you threw your curveball, and I crushed that. And Gibson's third best pitch by far was his curveball.
Oh, no doubt.
He basically lived with a slider, a fastball that had tremendous movement and a great slider as his off-speed pitch. And his curveball was just kind of ordinary. And he always said that that was kind of telling. That Williams is telling him right there, don't throw the curveball so much.
Well, his out pitch was that ride the stairway fastball way high. It started low and it would end up like at the catcher's top of the helmet level in the strike zone, and hitters just could not lay off of it, and they couldn't hit it either.
Deal with it. It would start low. You're right. It would rise and it would just move to the left. It was like a cutter, but a really hard one.
Correct. Correct.
And then a lot of times he said he attributed it to his success to an instance where he threw the fastball, a guy swung and missed, and the hitter said, he looked at him and said, throw me that slider one more time. So he thought that the fastball was his slider. And I think
exactly. A lot of hitters were turned around like that. And, you know, baseball lost an all-time great. The Cardinal Nation, it's just you know, they're beside themselves this year, besides what's going on.
They really are. They really are.
The baseball team wasn't all that great. And the fact is that this is one of the biggest losses since Stan Musial, really.
Well, it's the fourth Hall of Famer we've lost this year.
No doubt.
Lou Brock, Tom Seaver, and Al Kaline. And this is a tough one. This is a bitter pill. So rest in peace.
So let's talk about the wild card round.
Yeah,
we have a lot to cover today. So
it ended this week, and I'm going to quickly just mention that there were 8 playoff series between the National and the American League, and in 7 of them, I had a serious rooting interest in one form or another. Just a team that I knew I wanted to win, and all 7 of them lost. You know, all 7 of them.
Yeah,
the Cubs lost. The Cardinals lost. The Reds lost. I hate the Astros. I wanted the Twins to win. That didn't happen. The White Sox lost to the A's. The Indians lost to the Yankees. I mean, it was just, you know.
And the Twins lost. The fact is the American League Central was swept out in the wild card round.
Yeah.
And the National League Central. Baseball Central.
Well, the Cardinals had one game. The Cardinals got one win in San Diego.
Okay, not swept out, but they lost. The Central Division, AL-NL, is gone.
Is gone. Yeah. Yeah.
I would never have predicted that.
I don't have an answer. I can't look at that and say, well, this is why that happened. You know, just like I can't, you know, you look at certain teams and why they didn't win. And I don't know. It's just, it's hard to, it's a bitter pill to swallow. Now, part of me also thinks that, you know, given all the circumstances of this year with the pandemic and everything related to that, we were lucky to have any baseball at all. We were lucky to have something to even look at. So I'm grateful that the Cubs won the division, and that's how I'm going to deal with it moving forward.
Well, I think that in all of those games, unfortunately for me, I saw a good portion of them. But like you, I did. I actually saw a couple innings of the Dodgers game. But they're you know, I can't stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning and watch.
No, I can't. Yeah, neither can I. I'm not. I mean, unless I'm doing this. If you want to pay me money to do this, I do this for a living. I'll stay up and watch them all.
Yeah, I still would use a DVR, but. You know, I think that the what occurred in the wild card round largely was that the glaring holes of individual teams became even more glaring on the national stage, and the problems that the team suffered from in the regular season came back to haunt them in this short three-game series. And, you know, that was never so evident as it was for the White Sox, who, by the way, the A's shrewdly never threw a left-handed pitcher at them.
Well, they opened. That was really interesting. I'm glad you brought that up. That was really interesting when they started Jesus Luzardo in the first game, a left-hander.
Right.
And then Tim Anderson tweeted, "What are you guys doing? Don't you know we're 14-0 against left-handers?"
Exactly.
And the White Sox win the opener, but they lose the series.
But make that 15-0 against lefties. And you're right. That left-hander, as I recall, because Giolito almost threw a perfect game, or was throwing a perfect game. And that's where all the, you know, the attention was. But you're right. They started with that pitcher, but I'm not so sure he stayed in the game very long. He went right to a right-hander after that. And you're right. The Sox killed left-handed pitching. But some of the holes that the Sox had that we talked about, which, by the way, all of the central teams were impacted.
Yeah, everybody's fault. There's nobody in the group talking about.
Every single one of them.
Yeah,
With the exception, I would say, of maybe the Indians, because the Indians, you know, played a Yankee team that all of their players were back in the lineup and had only been together for five games all season long. I'm talking about Giancarlo Stanton, you know, Aaron Judge, and having Gleyber Torres and having Voit, who's led the majors in home runs, having all of these guys in the lineup at the same time. It had only happened five times. And so I thought the Indians, by the way, I went to bed on the second night when they ultimately lost 10-9 or 11-9 or whatever it was, they were winning going into the ninth inning, like 9-8. And their relief pitching, which is what they're known for, betrayed them. So every team in the playoffs suffered through, or every losing team, I think that their issues are very glaring. We'll talk about the Cubs in a different segment.
But I don't think the Cubs or a lot of these teams, they'll win those series, even if they're seven games.
No, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. But, you know, the fact that the Twins have lost 18 straight playoff games, that defies any – I mean, even, you know, even a –
What does that go back to? Does that include, like, the blackout game that happened, you know, the
early part of the century the century is when it goes back. It goes back to like 2003 or four or something like that. And they played the multitude of different teams that, you know, I know that the Tigers have beat up on them. I know that the A's have beat up on them. So it's just, but mostly the Yankees of lately. So I don't know what the solution is for the Twins, but those behemoth big home run hitters did not show up in the playoffs. You know, Tampa Bay looks like the most complete team in the American League, but I still think that the Dodgers are the best team in baseball because as good as Tampa Bay is from a pitching standpoint, their hitting is just – I'm sorry, from a hitting standpoint, their pitching is pedestrian. Like, Tampa Bay's hitting is extremely good, just like Atlanta. Like, the Atlanta Braves hitting is – people don't realize that the Cubs face the best offensive team.
Well, what's interesting about Tampa Bay is, you know, you're dealing with players who are all kind of lower budget players.
Yes, yes.
You know, but they're all pretty good low budget players. Nobody's a star, but, you know, they can manage. Kevin Cash can really play matchups. He has guys who are effective against right-handed hitters or pitchers and left-handed pitchers and vice versa with his, you know, he can sort of play around with matchups, and he's very smart, and they're sort of, they're very analytical as an organization. I think that they're the team that's going to be the toughest to beat. I don't want to see, for personal reasons, I don't want to see the Dodgers win anything. I hope they're eliminated immediately.
But I hope that I hope those two teams face off.
Yeah.
That's the best for baseball. So when we go on to the National League, the Braves swept out the Reds, and the Reds suddenly
could not hit at all. Yeah.
I mean, it just and that's kind of the thing that they did a really good job in the offseason of refortifying. I just the Reds have some soul searching to do because they have way too much talent for that performance.
They'll be firing their hitting coach, I'm sure. But yeah, that's generally what happens in a situation like this, is you've got to put a head on the block to chop off.
Right.
But I mean, you know, again, we criticize the Reds for scoring no runs in 23 innings.
Right.
You know, in two games, because one game went 18 innings, right? But then, but by the same token, I mean, the Cubs weren't any better.
No, one run,
you know, in two games. So,
and the Dodgers swept out the Brewers, and immediately, and there's some truth to this. There's some criticism about the fact that the Brewers, why are you in the playoffs? I mean, you never were 500 the whole season. And you're in the, you know, and the same thing within the American League, the Astros, I believe, were two games under 500.
Yeah, they were.
I don't, you know, obviously COVID created this 60 game season, and the end result of this, you know, 16 teams made the playoffs. I think they've got to really look at that in the off season, because it's just too many teams.
Yeah. Well, I think we do right now at this point, and I'm talking about our show here, we do need to jump forward a little bit. And I think I want to talk about something that White Sox fans were kind of irate about.
Yeah.
You know, because they were mad that Lucas Giolito in the opening game against the A's had a perfect game going, I think, through 6 2/3 or 6 1/3.
No, six full innings. He entered the seventh inning with a perfect game.
With a perfect game. And ESPN, sort of as an entity, went to their Twitter page and tweeted that Lucas Giolito was pitching a perfect game, which ended pretty much that inning, right?
Well, they were said it on the thing. It was kind of like that old Howard Cosell routine. During the game, they're like, that was the perfect swing. Speaking of perfect, Giolito, you know, they kept rubbing it in throughout the whole thing about
– And they kept bringing it up and so on and so forth. And White Sox fans took to Twitter in response – and we're very upset that ESPN had jinxed the no-hitter, which, by the way, I mean, this is complete nonsense, okay? White Sox fans, you need to, you know, sort of wake up to reality and understand that you have no influence over what happens in a baseball game.
Not just that, as a fan, act like you've been there before. Yeah. These are like rookie mistakes, because if the Sox win the next day, you never talk about this ever again, ever. Yeah. You never bring it up ever again. And so I just think, you know, I think the White Sox started to see the train coming at them, the fans, that is, and they just did like a lot of White Sox fans do, because their IQs are so low. They resort to the lowest common denominator. I've seen it time and time again.
I wanted the White Sox to win. I really did. I was pulling for them. I was hoping they would win. I was hoping they would come back. But also, you know, there was a glaring lack on their pitching staff of a reliable third starter.
Yeah.
You know, they had Giolito. They had Keuchel, and they had nothing.
We talked about that all season.
They were warming up a reliever after one hitter was faced in the first inning of the third game.
We talked about this all year long, that this was going to come to bite them. I didn't think it would come to bite them this quickly.
But
you're right. They were completely handcuffed by their inability to have timely hitting mixed with a pitching that could endure. They got into too many situations in their games. Remember, it went three games. It could have gone to the Sox. They actually won the first game.
Won the first game, and they were in the third, you know, which is far more than the Cubs can say, I'll tell you that. But, you know, it just didn't happen. And, you know, they're an erratic team. They really are. And they need to kind of – there's some things that have to calm down. They have to tighten things up. They have to play a more – complete game. They have to have a deeper rotation, a deeper bullpen. I mean, it didn't help that guy Crochet was injured, you know, that guy who throws 100 miles
right up. right
but at the same time, I mean, you know, that's tough, but you have to deal with it. You have to find ways around it. You have to win in spite of it.
Well, we had in the 60-game stretch of a season, they were phenomenal this year.
They came back to earth. One point the number one seed in the American
League. But neither of us thought – well, actually, we both thought that they might make the playoffs, but I just thought they played pretty well, and they've got a tremendous offense, and they've got a tremendous future. I'm not so convinced that the manager is the manager of the future. I think the Sox have a very young, talented team, but Renteria was like Doug Collins. I think they need another manager to take them to the next level. But – that's just a personal thought. So,
One last thing I want to mention: if Luis Roer plays better, they probably win that playoff series, and they probably finish higher in the American League and probably win that division. I mean, you know, he's a rookie; he obviously has tremendous talent. I think he's going to have a tremendous career.
This
season lost him the Rookie of the Year award and probably lost the White Sox playoff glory.
I think that he was performing poorly because you were mispronouncing his name.
Luis Roer.
Robert.
But if you're speaking Spanish.
I know.
Spanish speaker would say, él se llama Luis Roer.
Yeah.
You
do and you'll clean it up.
Yeah.
So now
the A's have to face the whistleblower, the guy who told the Athletic that the Astros were cheaters.
Yeah.
And now they face each other in the playoffs, and Friars will probably start a game against the Astros.
I think he's starting the first game. So,
wow. You
know, well, Dusty comes out and says, we've never spoken his name all season. I'm calling bullshit.
Yeah, bullshit on that.
Yeah. There's a few players on that team.
You know what they did? They called him the asshole. Yeah. That's what they did.
Yeah.
They didn't use his name.
Yeah, well, there's two or three players on that team went to bed every night, you know, throwing darts at the Mark Friar.
Yeah, they had a little Mark Friar's dog.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and they were stabbing it with a needle, you know.
Yeah. So, you talk about a 60-game stretch, and New York Times had a great article this week about the best 60-game stretch in Major League history. Why don't you kind of lead that one off, and let's talk about
it's Ichiro Suzuki, and Tom and I don't need any excuse to talk about Ichiro Suzuki. You know, we're talking about one of the greatest players who's ever lived. This is a generational sort of talent, and his talent wasn't necessarily a physical talent, although he had great hand-eye coordination, but it really rather was born from a absolutely disciplined dedication to his craft. To improving and being better, to honing the swing, to doing things so perfectly. And that's really, I mean, you see this is a big part of the Japanese character, you know, to dedicate your life to doing one thing absolutely perfectly. And in 2004, he set a record. I think he hit, how many hits? It was the 262 hits. Which
262
is
hits, Major League hit. Still a record.
And I think what the old record was 257, obviously, who, you know, throughout that same 60-game stretch had 172 hits. And he goes on to break the old record by George Sisler, which was 256, you know, and he ends with just this insane total of hits. And, you know, he didn't hit 400 because Ichiro's on-base percentage was pretty low, you know what I mean, or was low in comparison to his batting average. But you know, this is – I would think, and I think it's an accurate declaration that this was the best 60-game stretch that any hitter had ever had.
Yeah, without a doubt. I view Ichiro as the all-time hits king. I hate to say it because he came into the majors at such a late age and had already hit, I think, 11 or 1,200 hits in the Japanese leagues. So I just don't touch his bats. That's what I learned about him.
And
there's a chance that right now, as we speak, he's doing something baseball related. Is he hitting a bat? Does he have bat in his hand? Does he have a ball in his hand? Because he is the most devout baseball player I've ever come across. And he was the greatest student of the game in the history of the game. I've never seen anybody who was a student of the game like Ichiro was.
There was nobody more dedicated to practice, to practicing with intention, to work on something, to improve on something that will, you know, give him more of an edge, that hones his edge to a finer point.
Right.
It's just tremendous. And you're right. When you compare him to Rose, you know, Rose, I think, had a style very similar to Ichiro's. I mean, there were guys who were completely dedicated to making contact and putting the ball in play, you know, and there, you know, Rose was a switch hitter, whereas Ichiro only bat left-handed, but Ichiro was a far better complete player than Rose ever was. And I think that you're right. If he had been, if he'd played in the U.S. majors his entire career, he absolutely would be the all-time hit king.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it seems like there's going to be a lot of manager movement going on now.
A lot of manager movement. And it's not because it begins with guys sort of resigning or retiring. They weren't fired. They weren't shown the door. But in the case of the Boston Red Sox, Ron Renneke, after 1 year, a disastrous year at the helm of the Red Sox, is resigning. Yeah. And my assumption is that they're going to bring back Alex Cora. But this is interesting because Ron Gardenhire, who manages your Tigers, also decided to retire.
A week left in the season, which is bizarre. I don't get that, but anyways.
I don't know. Maybe he had to get to that timeshare in Boca. I don't know. But the point is that now the Tigers have to find a new manager. And there was an article in, I don't know, NBC Sports or something that says that the Tigers won't rule out considering hiring AJ Hinch, or Alex Cora. And I want to say that I want to call bullshit on this article.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because the headline says Tigers won't rule out, you know, Hinch and Cora. Okay. What actually happened in the article, if you read it.
I know. I did.
Reporters asked Al Avila if they were going to hire if they would hire Cora or Hinch. And Avila just said, we just haven't come to a decision yet.
Yeah.
And we just gave that as an answer. Yeah, there's no way they're hiring either of those guys.
Right. We haven't ruled anything out. And you're right. That was just basically.
So if you haven't ruled anything out, we can print that, you know.
That's correct.
Considering Hinch and Cora.
Right. Which is not an issue. But I think that there might be, if the Red Sox hire Cora, I'm calling bullshit on the whole thing of what they presented it to the press. This is like trying to get a medical report out of the Trump White House. It's the same thing. You're not going to really get anything close to being the truth.
Yeah, yeah. I think the Red Sox role in the cheating scandal is far more shadowy. And you know, Cora
specifically.
Yeah.
Cora specifically is far more shadowy. So if he gets hired back just like that, to me, it's almost a slap on the wrist. First of all, it wasn't even a full season. They should have to serve a full 162, baby.
So you're saying they need to serve another 102 games?
Correct. Going into next year. Seriously, if I ran the world, what kind of a penalty is this?
I know.
Especially if Cora goes back to the Red Sox. I view Cora to be worse than Hinch, and I view Hinch in a very bad light. But Cora was kind of one of the creators of the whole process. That's my take on him. And I wouldn't hire him. And I know he's going to get hired. We talked about this already, but I wouldn't hire him.
Well, I think we need to jump ahead and talk about the removal subsequently on another topic of Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis's name.
Right.
From the MVP trophy. And I think that this is a good thing that baseball is doing. I think it's high time it was done. I think it's high time that baseball recognizes that, you know, men like Landis really worked actively to keep African-Americans from playing Major League Baseball. And that conduct is beyond shameful. And to have his name on the MVP trophy is, I don't know, a slap in the face. So, but that brings us, I don't want to talk about how bad a guy Landis was.
Right.
I want to ask you whose name we should add. You know,
maybe Jackie Robinson. I don't know.
Well, he's already the rookie of the year, you know, and I liked Frank Robinson because he's the guy who won the MVP in both leagues.
That's true. That's a very good suggestion. Or here's a weird perverted thought. Keep Landis's name on it, and every time it comes up every year, it forces people to talk about this a little bit, because if you just take his name out off of it, I don't know what that does for the movement. Even though it has to happen, I agree with that. But I also kind of like the idea that, you know, Landis has a nephew that I guess is 98 years old. Did you know this?
Yeah.
He's the last living relative. And he's like, hey, please don't take his name off. Of course you're going to say that.
Yeah, of course you're going to say that. But, yeah, it's got to come off.
It's got to come
off. You know, and again, I mean, I don't want to look back too critically on the time, because the times, you know, racism was acceptable. You know, it's hard to.
You know, maybe here's the thought. Name it after Henry Aaron.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The last Negro leaguer who played in the majors, you know.
Yeah.
So, all right. So let's get to the Cubs. And
do we have to?
I don't know. This may be a pretty brief discussion. The Cubs went out with a whimper in the 2020 playoffs. They did manage to win their division. And, you know, that's good. In a division that was really good, the Central was the only division in baseball that had four teams with 29 wins or more. So, you know, you could argue that they faced the toughest schedule. But they didn't really set the world on fire this year, did they, Tom?
No. I'm going to give you some straight talk here now at this point. I've been kind of waiting all week to have this this diatribe that's about to come out of my mouth. Basically, the Cubs have been the same team for the last four seasons.
They've been the same team at this time of the year.
But the problems of the Cubs have basically been the same all the way through.
Yeah.
And so what I'm going to advocate is something that's rather harsh, and that is I believe that on the offensive side of the field, which has proven time and time again that they cannot hit in a timely manner, needs to be broken up, and in a major way. So how does that start? Well, the first contract that's up is Rizzo, and it's $15 million. In my opinion, they need to go in a different direction. I hate to say it because he's such a great Cub, but they have to break up that offense. And the reason why is this is Sparky 101. You've had numerous seasons and the result has been the same. Same for Schwarber. You can't bat 220 in the major leagues. You can't bat 185 in the major leagues. You got to go. They've got it. In my mind, If this was a card game, I'm keeping Baez and Contreras, and I'm getting rid of everybody else.
Wow.
That's how strongly I feel that the Cubs have been spinning their wheels for a while. This isn't on Rossi at all. In fact, Rossi did a fine job. He did exactly what Madden would have done. Madden would have had the same exact result. Yeah. It's not the manager. It's the personnel. Here's another thing too. When you go out and get 10 relief pitchers and hoping one of them sticks up against the wall, the reality is when you go out and get 10 junky arm relief pitchers, you end up having 10 junky arm relief pitchers. That's what I'm trying to say.
Here's where I'm gonna.
Okay.
Look, they had some success in the bullpen. They actually did have some success.
Kimbrough got lit up. I'm just telling you, this is old,
but
tired
of those
arms.
Of those junky arms they acquired, they had some production. You know, I don't think the problem was what they did with either their starting pitchers or their relievers. You know, and we're also talking, you know, losing Quintana, losing Chatwood probably cost them, you know, being the number one seed or number two seed anyway.
Right, they weren't ever
in the playoffs, number two seed. You know, so not having those guys going forward. But obviously the problem is with hitting. They're not scoring runs. And I think it's a collective approach to the process of hitting. I mean, maybe it's part of it not being able to look at the video equipment during the game, you know, and maybe that really affected Baez. Maybe it affected Schwarber too. But I contend that it is their collective approach to take these pitches to what, you know what I mean? They need to be more aggressive in their approach, but then there's a cost that comes with that too. I don't know.
Give me new players. That's my solution. I don't want the same.
I would keep
players.
At least one left-handed hitter. I would keep Schwarber, and maybe I would keep Baez, because Baez has so much value with the glove.
It turns out this is a late-breaking story last night that came out and basically said Theo Epstein, who's meeting with Ricketts, that it's entirely possible that he could walk away right now, which, you know, remember when Theo...
Well, his contract is good through till next year, but he could leave.
But so if you go back to when he first hired in, he said they always should change every 10 years.
Yeah.
And he's coming up on that And I have to say, I love Theo. You know, you'll never buy another drink in this town, but I do believe that change is necessary for the Cubs, and you may get caught up in it. I don't know. All I know is Rossi, who had no cards given to him except for what the team was last year, and basically the result was the same, did a commendable
division,
job.
Tom, how can you say that? They won the division.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, okay, that's like saying you're the world's tallest midget. They were in with teams that ultimately, with the exception of maybe the Cardinals, turned out to be mediocre or less. The whole division is. The American League one turned out to be that way too. But the fact is the Cubs have to make some major changes, because if you don't, then it's kind of the definition of insanity. If you keep those same players out there, you're going to get the same result. That's what I'm trying to say.
I think – that discussion that happened with Tom Ricketts and Theo Epstein was probably centered on how he's going to leave this team, you know, and he wants to leave the team under the best possible circumstances going forward. And I think the best possible thing to do might be to completely refit, rebuild, retool.
Yes.
You know, maybe you're not going to get value for these guys in trades, but you'll certainly get out of the way of some big paydays. And what you need to do is start dedicating those resources internally, especially because, you know, money's going to be tight in the pandemic as we recover. I think they should put that into player development. They need to acquire as much young talent as possible and just try to move up that way. And if Epstein can leave them like that with a stocked cupboard, then I think he feels okay about his job here, the job he did.
All of those things are on the table. First of all, they don't have a stock covered because their minor league system does not have the talent that other minor league
covered
system
had.
It is bare. And by the way, that's kind of the Dombrowski approach, which is, you know, mortgage the future for the present. And again, I'm not critical of Theo, and I'm fine with him staying, but I just think that they have to really shake things up, because if they don't, you're going to get the same result. Don't go into the next season like you did this past saying, we're going to be this great team, we're changing the way how we're holding the players accountable, but you're not doing anything to the impacting the talent, adding or subtracting it, which they didn't do. I just think the result's going to be the same. And the result was the same. And also, had there been a full season, I'm not convinced the Cubs would have even made the playoffs, because they were starting to fade in that 60-game stretch. They came out of the gate strong, and they faded horribly, and it shows. And so I just think that they need to make some changes, and I think the Cubs realize that they need to do that. I do think in the next couple of years, the financial aspect of baseball is going to completely change because of COVID. You're not going to see $45 million a year guys, because until baseball starts seeing that revenue come back at the stadium level, which it's not now, there's no way these players are going to make this kind of money. The TV contract can only go so far. That's the problem.
You know, maybe I'll buy season tickets. You want to go in on season tickets, Tom, you and me?
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
We'll get it. No, seriously, I got it picked out. We'll get it in the upper deck right behind home plate where they have that little club, you know?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I'll do it. All right. So, That takes care of our peanuts segment, rather long one. Yeah. A lot to talk about. I want to get right to the popcorn. And you chose the movie this week. You gave us On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando, Rod Steiger, Carl Malden, Eva Marie Saint, directed by the great Elia Kazan. And I saw it again this week. I read about it, and I learned something about this film that I did not know. And that Elia Kazan made this movie because he wants to justify testifying in front of the Committee for Un-American Activities and
That's
cooperating
correct.
With them.
That's correct.
Because he's saying that this guy Malloy, who blows the whistle on the union and the things that they're doing down on the docks,
That's right.
The same moral justification for him testifying against communists within Hollywood. And, you know, that kind of pissed me off when I read that. But I'll tell you this, it doesn't diminish the fact that it's a tremendous movie.
Yeah. No, actually, that's the complete side story. That is, you're correct. The film is a metaphor for what Kazan was dealing with in Hollywood. And that's one of the reasons why he was so drawn to the project. But it's much more than that. This is a film which was loosely based on a true story.
Right.
I think like in 1948, it was a few years before that. And Holly was very skittish about really talking about unions and corruption in unions because they were getting so much pressure. And so they had to kind of, you know, tiptoe around that. And Kazan, who became a pariah for what he did ultimately, and in fact is, he should have been scorned the way he was scorned for his behavior, but he makes a masterpiece here. This film,
he really does.
Which is 22nd on my list. I've seen 90 of the 92 best pictures on the big screen, and this one comes in at number 9. It's a phenomenal film. It is the second of the two triumphant acting jobs by Brando.
Yeah.
A Streetcar Named Desire and On the Waterfront, and you can hold those two films up to any actor that's ever lived in the history of film. And in fact, it was so breathtaking to see Brando on the screen because he was the first actor in film history to act normally on the screen, yeah, as opposed to stagey or you know, like some of the film histrionics of the 30s and the 40s. He eschewed all of that. He was kind of a method actor till the day he died, and it shows, and some of the scenes are just unforgettable in the film.
I do want to quickly recount the story, but basically the dock worker, Terry Malloy, working in the docks in Hoboken, New Jersey, you know, he finds out he's got an easy job. He was a former boxer. The union takes care of him, but the union is really corrupt. And the union throws someone off of a building who's going to testify against them. And then sort of, you know, Malloy finds out more about this and the same pressure is applied to him, where he finally feels like he has to tell the world what these guys are doing down here and how bad it really is. And he has to do this when everybody around him is telling him, you know, not to do this. This is the classic man versus society conflict.
Correct.
You know, where you're fighting against the rules and traditions, and everybody wants you to just sort of go along with it, but you can't. You have a moral code. You were taught right from wrong. And, you know, it is brilliant. And what I love about this movie is that directors love this movie. I saw interviews with Martin Scorsese, who talked about how Kazan's decision to film on the docks in Hoboken was huge. They wanted to do it in Red Hook, but you know what happened? The mafia told them, if you film the movie in Red Hook, we're going to kill Kazan. We're going to kill Brando.
Right,
threatened him. Right, so they had to go to Hoboken. You know, and how much affection he had for it. And Lee said that, you know, Brando's decision when he's walking with Eva Marie Saint and she drops her glove and
he just goes
on, he picks it up and even puts it on. And it's just this tremendous sort of little.
Brando came up with that. They kept that in the movie.
And Lee was saying that another actor might go, hey, cut, she dropped her glove. Hey, stop. You know what I mean? But he went ahead with it and it was beautiful.
Well, he accepted the fact that Brando was going to improvise a lot in the film and, in fact, had to be told that, in fact, at one point, Kazan said, hey, you know, cut the shit out, stick to the script, you know, because there was one more that scene in the taxi cab with his brother Charlie. He actually at one point was like, hey, you think the Yankees are going to win it all this year? You know, and Kazan is like, what is that? That it's not in the script. What are you doing?
Yeah exactly. No, it must have been maddening.
Yeah.
To work with Brando, but when he was young, and certainly, you know, in a many, many movies, you see his genius. You see how special he was as an actor. I mean, he was completely crazy, and I think you have to be a little crazy to be a genius. You know, there are times when he's laughable, especially later on. But then when he's young, I mean, he completely owns every moment he's on screen.
There's no doubt. And I would say, if you really want a starter on Brando, go watch A Streetcar Named Desire, because his acting is, if I taught film, that would be what I would show all young male actors, that this is how you inhibit a character. And the viewer, as you watch a Brando early performance, you actually believe that he's really that character.
Yeah.
And that's a very unusual thing. That's very rare. It's kind of like with De Niro, with Raging Bull. You're like, hey, you know what? I think he probably could have won a couple of boxing matches. You know, he seemed very skilled. And the same thing with Brando. Brando lived the part. And Kazan and Brando drifted apart years after this film was made. They hardly spoke to each other. But Kazan always said that Brando, in that that area, you know, it was extremely cold that winter when they filmed that. Whenever I see the movie come on, it's like, hey, I got to go put a sweater on. It comes up, it gives you kind of like, it's cold outside. It's kind of nasty. This is a gritty thing that these Americans, you know, have to go through. Most people don't know the story of the longshoremen and what they do. And, you know, just some of the crap that they had to deal with back in the day. And I just, you know, this film, the only criticism, I agree with Ebert's whole thing, but I agree with what he said that, you know, maybe there's kind of too much of a stagey ending to the film. And, you know, because I think the story, the original story, Johnny Friendly wins. He doesn't lose at the end like he does it on the waterfront, right? He goes on being corrupt and killing people. That's more closely to what really happens, I think. But that's the only criticism that you could really come up with is that maybe it's too much of an optimistic ending, but I'll make you the case that it's perfect in the mood that it's trying to set, that Malloy was so conflicted about right or wrong, ultimately right won the day. And it's a love story that I'm sure Eva Marie Saint, who is 98 years old, which is just amazing. She's still alive.
She's still with us, wow.
Two more years, she'll be 100 years old. She was the same age as Brando, even though Brando's supposed to be like her older friend of her older brother type of a guy. They were the same age. She won an Oscar. You know, it won 8 Oscars of the 11 that it was nominated, which tied a record.
That's quite, yeah. That is, well, yeah.
So you're talking about a film with big chops, and I just, you know, it also reminded me of The Third Man in the sense that it had that mood that was established by Kazan, like you said, of just actually being right there. This was not on a set out in California.
Yeah.
This was the real thing.
you've really selected some great movies, and you know, I can only I don't know if I can compete with that. But the movie that I have suggested for next week is a smaller movie, a less influential movie, but nevertheless a movie that I enjoy every time I see it. And that is Bend It Like Beckham by Gurinder Chadha with Keira Knightley and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers I love this movie. I love the soundtrack, and we're going to talk more about why I love it next week on Peanuts and Popcorn. So until then, we are the Two Peas in a Podcast.
I'll bang the drum slowly and play the fife lowly. Play the dead march as they carry me along. Put bunches of roses all over my coffin, roses to deaden the clouds as they fall.